We hope to be talking shortly with Thomas Mountain, and then, of course, later with Mick Lowe. Mick Lowe's new book is called The Insatiable. I guess some say insatiable, some say potatoes, some potatoes, insatiable maw. The Nickel Range Trilogy. If you really want to know about an important part of Canadian history and politics, you got to read Mick's novels. And I think we're joined now by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Mr.
Hey.
Mountain? The man from the mountain.
Good to be back in Guantanamo. Toronto.
You are in a – we just talked to a man who tried to deliver medical supplies to Yemen, and the Saudis bombed him. I bet you weren't surprised at that kind of behavior.
Well, it's not only the Saudis. The American Navy blocked the Iranian supply ship and forced it to detour to Djibouti.
Indeed.
They prevented the Iranians from landing the supply ship.
It's now is that making what is this? We heard talk that something might be developing there in a way of negotiations or whatnot. Your latest article failed the America's failed states policy. What's going on there in Yemen? A destroying of the system per se.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's reports now that the Americans have bypassed the Saudis and are negotiating with the Houthi rebels in Yemen, in Oman. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the case of Yemen, you know, the United States, of course, is like Somalia. If they can't control the government there, they, you know, the last thing they want is an independent, nationalist, potentially Islamic government in a power on the at the very mouth of the Bab al-Mandeb, the gateway between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean, because all the trade between Asia and Europe, which is the biggest trading partners in the world and some one-third of all the world's oil, passes through there every day. So who controls the Bab al-Mandeb controls the two biggest economies in the world, Asia and Europe. Mm-hmm. So the last thing the United States wants is either in Somalia or in Yemen to have a strong, independent, nationalist, potentially Islamic government there. Mm-hmm. So if they can't control it, yes, they'd prefer a failed state. And, you know, back in 2006, the Union of Islamic Courts brought peace to Mogadishu for the first time in 15 years and established a government in Mogadishu. And what did the Americans do? Because they were independent, nationalist, and Islamic, they sent the Ethiopian army in to destroy that and basically launched what became Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab used to be part of the youth wing of the Union of Islamic Courts, and it was the Ethiopian invasion which drove out the older, more conservative nationalist elements and left the young Al-Shabaab, which in Arabic means the youth, there to fight the Ethiopian occupation. And what became of that was, well, today the group in Somalia that's causing all this trouble called Al-Shabaab. Well, in Yemen, you know, there was peace in Yemen, and there'd been a deal worked out way back in 1990 under the mediation of what was then the rebel Eritrean People's Liberation Front, which brought both North and South Yemen together and negotiated a peace and a unity government in Yemen. And then that kind of lasted for a long time, and then the Americans stepped in and took over and got the former president, Saleh, to allow the Americans to come in and start drones and assassination and this massive campaign of murdering people in the name of fighting al-Qaeda. And, you know, it led to this situation where eventually the conditions in Yemen got so bad that the Yemen people just couldn't take it anymore, and there was this uprising and the alliance between the Yemen army, which is headed by the son of the former President Saleh, and the Houthi militias, who have been fighting the Saleh-led government for many years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they made a move to take over the government and stabilize the place. Well, America can't have that. But the interesting thing is the U.S. military was firmly against the Saudis going into Yemen. This is the United States military. They actually had some of their spokesmen, unofficial spokespersons, come out and criticize what the Saudis are doing, because the military were at least aware of the fact that the potential dangers of having a a war against the Yemeni people where this could lead, because the Bab al-Mandeb at its narrowest is only about 12 miles across, which puts it in range, meaning all the ships passing through within range of even light artillery. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the potential for having several thousand artillery pieces stationed along the Yemeni coast, shelling ships going through there, is a nightmare of the U.S. military. So, you know, they're against it. And
but theirs is not the reason why theirs is about to do in whatever.
Well, the cowards in the U.S. Central Command, the military leadership, the generals are politicians, and they're really cowards. I mean, they wouldn't come out and say this is a disaster publicly. And
well, the headquarters is in Florida, you remember. That's how close they are to this.
Yeah, well, you know, they've come out now, and they're apparently the Americans and the Houthi militias are negotiating, because Americans realize if this keeps going on, this is going to turn into a major disaster. But by the way,
wouldn't that be a disaster? I mean, Saudi Arabia, you point out, this. You had an earlier article using and bringing in the haunted name Vietnam for Saudi Arabia. They if, unless they really prevailed, the ball could roll back toward them, couldn't it?
Oh, it's already, there's already blowback. But see, the situation in Saudi is that they have a new king, and the king put his favorite son, who's only 29 years old, and with no military background, he put him in as the Minister of Defense. This guy's got no background, and he decides that they're going to, what Saudi needs to do is to start showing their military strength. And so they're going to go out and they're going to, you know, go and attack Yemen and sort the matter out, make an example to Iran that they, you know, the Saudis are strong. Well, that's all backfiring on the Saudis.
I mean, they were good at beating up on Bahrain, but these are real fighters.
Yeah, the Houthis are real fighters. The last time the Saudis fought with the Houthis in 2009, they got their behinds kicked, and the Houthis ended up capturing a sizable chunk of Saudi territory. And Saudis had to apparently pay them many millions of dollars to pull back. Mm. So, you know, the Saudis don't really, they know better than to go in on the ground against the Houthis.
Well,
and even in Egypt.
Well, they must have their fingers crossed with these talks. Let me ask you a question. I never understood, nobody's explained, why is Oman so quiet about this? Because the other Gulf states all said, oh, yeah, we're with you, but not Oman.
Well, Oman's actually pretty close to Iran. And Oman, the government there is much more moderate. They're not this Wahhabi sect that the British installed in the Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and in Kuwait and Bahrain. The Omanis are more of a moderate Sunni sect, and they're not nearly as fanatic, and they're much more tolerant. They've got historical ties with Iran and with Yemen.
And then they share a choke point too on the other side of the peninsula.
Yeah. That's right. So Oman is they didn't join in this, and they've always been more of a, you know, in between, because they're actually quite close economically to Iran. Hmm. But see, this failed state policy is not always a deliberate. I mean, the American government can do such idiotic things that it's not always, you know, a deliberate. I mean, it's not like, let's go make a failed state here. What happens is, just through their own blundering, through their own incompetency, the policy becomes failed state, that they do stupid things that create a failed state. I mean, you know, they didn't think when they went into Iraq that they were going to have a failed state, but that's what they ended up with, because they're so stupid. I mean, George Bush didn't even know there was such a thing as Shia and Sunni. Hmm. So, you know, that was surprised him when he found that out after the fact. I mean, so, you know, there's times when it's conscious that, like in the case of Somalia, they would rather have a failed state than a strong, united, nationalist, potentially Islamic government there. In the case of Libya, you know, it's clear they destroyed it, and it was clear that they wanted to destroy the Gaddafi government. And I don't think even they realized that they were going to end up with that badly a failed state situation in Libya. But, you know, they would still, rather than to have the potential threat of Gaddafi funding a rival to the International Monetary Fund with a $40 billion investment fund that Africa could break the shackles of neocolonialism and the financial control of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, with the new African Investment Bank that Gaddafi was going to fund. Yes. You know, it's going to break the Africa out of the control of the dominant financial terrorists that have dominated Africa now since so-called independence, which I prefer to call neocolonialism. Yeah. So, you know, they would rather see Gaddafi in Libya, a failed state, than that happen. So,
yes.
You know, there's a lot of times when it's deliberate that the policy has come in and see a failed state if they can't control the situation.
It's the preferable solution.
Yeah, they prefer that.
In the last minute here, Thomas, I want to ask you, you raised the point that a lot of this policy is based on crowding China out, and you point out in South Sudan that the U.S. feels they've succeeded because the Chinese are prevented from continuing the oil business. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, you know, the only party to benefit from the civil war in South Sudan is the United States. Because the only Chinese-controlled oil field in Africa is in South Sudan. So it's in the United States' national interest to deprive China of access to the African energy market, which is one of the potentially biggest in the world, and undeveloped energy markets. So the Chinese had the oil fields in South Sudan. The Americans, the ones that wanted to get them out, the Americans actually got instigated a war, a fight between South Sudan and Sudan, over the allegedly over the price of the oil being transported to the oil pipelines, and got the Chinese kicked out, actually shut the fields down by promising the South Sudanese government that they would fund them for something like the tune of $200 million a month. Well, then the Americans reneged on that, and so the Salva Kiir government of South Sudan went back to the Chinese, got an $8 billion emergency loan, and reopened those oil fields, which pissed the Americans off. So what the Americans' response? They got the Ethiopians to come in and fund the so-called rebel army of Riek Machar, the supposedly vice president of South Sudan. Now, it's been a year and a half since the war has broken out in South Sudan, and there's still some oil is flowing. I mean, the Chinese have put 500 peacekeepers in around the oil field, and they've got the oil flowing again now, some of it. So there's been attacks on those oil fields, but the Chinese, nobody's talking about the Chinese peacekeepers there. But Riek Machar can't explain where he's getting any of his money, the so-called rebels. The South Sudanese government headed by Salva Kiir can explain. They've got some money coming in. But for a year and a half, Riek Machar has got, 15, 20,000 soldiers under his command. He's got to pay their salaries. He's got to feed them. He's got to provide fuel for their transport. He's got to provide ammunition. Where's he getting all that money from?
Yeah.
No one's talking about that.
He's
not funding this guerrilla war.
Exactly.
And the fact is, it's Ethiopia and acting as a proxy for the United States. And it doesn't take a whole lot of intelligence to figure out that the United States is the only beneficiary of this war. And who's the mysterious funder of Riek Machar? And what's Riek Machar's role? To get to shut down the Chinese oil fields in South Sudan. Now, everybody's making it seem like this is tribal violence and black-on-black violence in Africa, and Africans are animals, and all they can do is kill each other, and it's just a really sickening situation, and you know, Africans really don't deserve independence, and they can't even govern their own country. And again, when you really dig down a little bit, you find out that it's outside sources, in this case the United States, that's behind all this violence in South Sudan, all these hundreds of thousands of people starving. It's all, who's paying for it?
Yep.
And that's the question nobody in the Western media is asking, and it's so obvious.
Well,
how
that's
can Riek Machar fight a war?
That's why we turn to Thomas Mountain. Thomas, it's great talking to you, and you're a great source. Failed states policy and all your writings. Thanks very much.
Okay, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Look forward to seeing you. Bye-bye. That's Thomas Mountain. And writing from Eritrea, and he's absolutely right, of course. Most of these things, you really actually will not find out from the BBC or the New York Times. You have to go to Thomas Mountain if you want to know. That's why we call him up.